This is the RightsCast Network, brought to you by Dandelion Web Marketing, Lost Lake Press, and Kill Your Darlings Candle Company, and always streaming at rightscast.net. The winner of this month's critique for their first five pages is Matt. Congratulations, Matt. You have won a critique of your manuscript's first five pages from yours truly, all because you support our programming financially over at patreon.com/rightscast. If you're a listener to this show and you'd like access to awesome patron perks like chances to win a critique of your manuscript's first five pages, head to patreon.com/rightscast like Matt has done and sign up to support our programming at $1, $2, or $3 per month or per episode. All of it will get you entered in these great monthly drawing, so I hope to see you there. That's patreon.com/rightscast. All right, on with the show. This is episode 28 of Novel Approaches here on the RightsCast Network. Welcome to the RightsCast Network's Novel Approaches podcast, a craft-focused conversation for writers everywhere.
Because writing novels is hard, and we're all in this together.
Hey there, I'm author, writing coach, and candle kingpin, R.R. Campbell.
And I'm Maggie Derrick. I'm an author, an artist, and I am the guest host of the Novel Approaches podcast.
In this installment of Novel Approaches, brought to you by Dandelion Web Marketing, Lost Lake Press, and Kill Your Darlings Candle Company, we'll be discussing the how and the when of tackling second drafts. But first, Maggie, welcome back. How are things on this chaotic morning for you?
Things are going really well. Thank you for having me back.
Of course.
Yeah, it's been a chaotic morning. It's been just a chaotic few months, to be honest. I've been just really caught up. Earlier in the spring, I found out I was one of the Rev Pit winners for revise and resubmit. And so we're recording this at the end of June, and the showcase, the aging showcase, actually starts tomorrow. So it has been all revision all the time. So that's really kind of taken up the bulk of my time outside of, you know, working remotely and learning how to adapt to the, I hate saying the new normal out loud because it's kind of become cliche at this point, but the new normal.
Right. And I hear you on that. I just keep calling it like the quarantines because, like, though it is a new normal, I refuse to like give it the hug that it, you know, wants from me as some kind of normalcy. So
I love quarantines. That's excellent.
I think that it is way more appropriate than, and this is, I'm throwing shade. People out there know who they are, but they'll call this the great pause. And I'm like, how is this a great pause? You know, that's like,
what? I haven't heard that before. I don't like it.
Yeah, I don't like it either because what's on pause? You know, like, I don't know what's on pause if you're a white collar jerk like me who gets to like work from home for his part-time job and that's kind of on pause, but like frontline workers and healthcare and the service industry and people who have to actually confront this day to day, this is not a pause. And that is my rant on the pause.
Yeah, exactly. I think it's easy to forget that there are a lot of people who've had to continue and go about their everyday under significantly more stressful circumstances. And I don't think it felt like a pause for them. So, you know, kudos and applause all around for those fine folks.
Yes. And also not a pause for folks who are, say, one of the winners in this year's Rev Pit. So congratulations, Maggie, on that. I don't think I congratulated you in this space anyway, but I know how grueling that process can be as someone who has been an editor for it for a couple of years and took this year off to, you know, attend conferences that all got canceled.
Oh.
So it's okay. It was a nice little break and I got to kind of follow from a distance, but congratulations on getting through all of that. And with the showcase opening, I know that for listeners who are going to be tuning into this episode starting July, 10th, the showcase will be live and up, I believe, just on the Rev Pit website, right? So folks can check out the hard work that you've put into it over the course of the last couple months.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, first five pages, queries all go up tomorrow. I've been in conversation behind the scenes with all the other winners and everyone's really excited. So, and everyone's been working so hard and we've just been so lucky. I've been working with an editor named Michelle Rascon on my developmental edit and she's just been fantastic. And I'm just so excited because, you know, she really took the manuscript I had that I was feeling really good about and just made it so much better. And it's just, it's such a good feeling. I'm so glad I got to be part of this.
Well, and it's well deserved too. You know, I have to say that I was really intrigued, and maybe we should share this with listeners too, by the premise for the manuscript with which you worked with Michelle over the course of the last couple of months. Do you want to share that with listeners just to throw it out in the ether a little bit here?
Oh, yeah, sure. So what I've written is a 95,000 word young adult mystery. Mm. And because it's me, it's also queer. Mm-hmm. And the quick pitch that I've got for it is, being a teen witch who can see ghosts is hard enough without the dead meddling in your life. When Magni offers to help her crush figure out why she's being haunted, she uncovers a secret that's far worse than the relentless spirit that's haunting their every move.
Bam. And you've got it memorized. You are well practiced, or it's like on a wall right next to your laptop or next to your computer, but either way, can feel it. So that's the kind of thing you can look forward to from Maggie if you head to the revise resubmit website, which I believe is just revpit.com. If I have a thought to do so when I am typing up the episode notes here, I will just throw a link to RevPit and perhaps Maggie directly to your submission here. So folks can check that out. If you're listening on Apple Podcasts or you're on rightscast.net, check out those show notes and you can follow the link right through it. And I will say this, Maggie, quickly, just from what I've got going on in my end of the world, listeners, you know, at the top of this, I said candle kingpin. And last month I said something else about candles. I don't remember, all these months blur together. And you've been hearing the ads now starting in June and carrying us through July. Well, by the time you're listening to this, listener folk, the Kill Your Darlings candles web store will be open on July 15th, technically. Oh. But hey, I know it's here. The launch day is here. And Maggie, the same day that the showcase goes live for RevPit is actually the same day our website will officially be live. So folks, you've got a lot of things to look at in the show notes here. We're talking about the RevPit showcase. We're talking about kydcandleco.com. And if you order between July 15th and July 31st, you can get one of our Happily Ever After, Dramatic Irony, or Kill Your Darlings candles for 20% off. And we've got 10% of every order subtotal getting donated to organizations like We Need Diverse Books and Lambda Literary and Haymarket Books and just a lot of really great organizations that are supporting readers, writers, including some progress-minded nonprofit presses. So the opportunity is there, listeners. I would love it if you would come pay a visit and help me get out of the corporate hellscape. Don't tell my employers that. So, with that said, thank you for indulging me, Maggie. I think I'm ready for our true conversation here. How about you?
Yeah, me too. Let's do it.
All right. So we are talking today, as I promised at the top of the episode, about tackling second drafts, which is very apt for you, of course, because you've been going through some deep multiple, not just second drafts here with RevPit, but surely third and fourth and whatever number it comes out to be. But if you are a new listener to this program, here's how this works. Maggie and I will be sharing input from the writing community via our hashtag RightsCast chat that ran from the 24th through the 28th of June. And we asked you, listeners, questions about how you handle your second draft, some tips that you have, questions you might have. We're going to share your input from Instagram. We're going to share it from Twitter. And then we're just going to respond based on our own experience and provide advice where we can, some additional insight, and just generally, you know, share what the world thinks about tackling second drafts. So our first question today, and Maggie, we've got an Instagram post for this, so I'll let you take it away with the first post. But the question we asked the world here was, how long do you wait between drafts and why?
Mm-hmm. So our first comment comes from Lisa_McDougal_P, who says, they wait at least a month. I find the longer I wait, the better.
I really like that. That feels like some good general advice. So thank you, Lisa, for that contribution over on Instagram. And we actually have a similar comment here from someone who listeners to the RightsCast Network will recognize. This is Ikta Garg over on Instagram as Ikta R. Garg. Ikta, a past co-host here on Novel Approaches, also the new host of Biblio Breakdown. So a familiar voice, becoming even more familiar now through this episode. And this is what Ikta had to say on this. She's working on a talk for her local library that will be online, of course, about revisions and the need to take a break between drafts. And she is recommending to writers that after they finish that first draft, they take at least a month off. So comments there that are very similar to Lisa, though Ekta does also add here that having that space, it's not just about a formality of space, that it gives, at least her anyway, some objectivity and clarity. Does that resonate with you, Maggie? How long do you like to take between writing drafts for, say, between the first and second draft specifically?
Honestly, I like long waits. In the beginning, I used to think a week or two, I'll step away. And I think that was because I was still really in the moment and really hopped up on whatever I was working on. But over the years and the more experience I've gained as a writer, I found that the longer I wait, the better, because really being able to remove yourself from that project and come back to it with fresh eyes makes such a huge difference. If you're still really, I find, really invested and emotional about the piece that you've just spent a ton of time finishing, then it's a lot harder to start ripping it apart, because I feel that's a really tender time. So I find the longer I wait, the better suited I am to really tear the thing apart.
Right. And just coming to it with those objective eyes and with a new sense of clarity. Right. And I have found that perhaps it was similar for me too. You know, when you're a new writer and you've got that one awesome idea that you think you have for a manuscript and you're so excited that you finished your first draft, and like, that's the manuscript, man. Like, you feel so good about it. And all you want to do is jump right back in because you're confident that all you need to do is make sure you don't have any typos. And then that's the book, right? Well, you know, maybe not quite. As we learn, and I have found, you know, my experience similar to yours here, Maggie, that I do find that I need to get to a place of like almost total detachment from a project if I'm to truly come back to it. And this might sound a little out of the box to some folks, but my new thing in a second draft is I don't even save a new document, Maggie. I write right over what I wrote in that first draft. I have to be that confident that the time has come. Yeah, it's strange. And it was a hard hump to get over, but whether it's a month or like 3 months, for me, it's just a feel thing. It's when I know, okay, you know what? It's time to get back into Scambait, or it's time to get back into the third novel in the Empathy Saga. You just, sometimes you know, sometimes it's a gut check thing, at least for me anyway.
Yeah. I can definitely feel that. On the flip side though, we have a comment here from Avery Ames at Avery Ames over on Twitter. And she says, I give it a week. Ideally, I'd let it rest even longer, but I'm impatient at that stage, which I think we can all relate to. She goes on to say, I write extremely messy, short first drafts, though. So I let it rest longer between the cleaner version of the draft two and draft three. So they're looking ahead at the various drafts, not just draft two. But yeah, a week. I don't know if I could personally, to each their own. I don't think I could be far enough removed. I think I'd still be riding that wave. I know when I finished this manuscript that I'm working on for Rev Pit, it felt like I needed that first week just to catch my breath.
Right.
I felt like laid out for that first week. So anyone who's got the get up and go to jump right back in after a week is like almost, applause to you, because I don't have that stamina.
Well, and I'll say this too, in Avery's case, I think what's really fascinating here is that Avery seems to be recognizing, and this isn't the word that she's using here, but that insofar as first drafts are concerned, perhaps she is an underwriter as opposed to being an overwriter in your first draft. So I can see how perhaps in her case, you kind of want to catch the spirit while it's still there. And if you know you're an underwriter, it's like, well, I still have some proximity to this manuscript. I'm not so far removed that I have lost, you know, track of whatever threads I might have wanted to stitch in, or knowing where I'm going to have to, you know, pump this manuscript up a little bit more because I'm an underwriter. So maybe if you're an underwriter, this is a reasonable strategy to pursue, because you don't want to, as I sloppily said, and I'm sloppily saying now, lose the spirit, so to speak, when you have it, when you have that kind of proximity. So, hey, things we have to learn about ourselves, I guess, right? You know, underwriting, overwriting, how does it work? It's like magnets, right?
Yeah, for sure. This was actually the first draft I've ever purposefully overwritten on. I'm a chronic underwriter, and I've always struggled with that, because I find to get the story the way I want it to. And then it's like, I got to add another 20,000 words. Like,
right.
Where are those going? Whereas this time I purposefully was like, no, just keep going, add as much fluff in as you can. That was the NaNoWriMo spirit really helping me out there. And then I got to just like ruthlessly cut things out later. And I'm like, man, this is so much easier.
Right. Yeah. And I think there maybe is another dimension that it's worth exploring here in this sort of underwriting and overwriting paradigm that harkens back to last month's episode in talking about the intersection of inner conflict and theme. So I know personally for myself that I am an underwriter insofar as things like setting description, character description, really anything that is aesthetic. I am very much an underwriter for in a first draft, but I'm also very much an underwriter insofar as theme is concerned, because I like to use that first draft, as I probably said during last month's episode, I like to use that first draft to get a feel for story and to play with theme, and then use later drafts to sort of enhance it and make sure that it is shaped how I want it to be shaped. And so I don't know, maybe it's not just about, am I an underwriter, you know, capital U, or an overwriter, capital O. It's, am I an underwriter of XYZ? Am I an overwriter in these areas? And if we know kind of where our strengths and weaknesses are, then when it comes time to do second and subsequent drafts, we're in a really strong position to figure out exactly what it is we need to be doing some more writing on and where it is that we need to be doing that cutting. So I don't know, just it's a little more nuance, I guess.
Yeah, I completely agree. There are definitely things that I tend to gloss over a bit when I'm doing my first draft. So that makes sense to me.
And we do have another comment here from Whitney Hill over on Twitter. Whitney tweets at @write_wherever. And Whitney had this to say, I just finished a first draft on Sunday. I waited until today to start figuring out the next book in the same series. I won't go back to the other draft until I've written enough of the next book to know where I need to fix something or plant more seeds in the one before. And this adds, I think, a new layer to this conversation, which is the idea that if you know you're writing in a series, how do you decide when to do your first draft of every book versus the second draft of every book? And so thank you, Whitney, for introducing this new aspect of the discussion in here, because I think it is something that it's really worth considering. And I don't know, Maggie, I know with the Starborn series, maybe this is something that you have had some experience with. What's your approach been like when you're writing out the different books there when it comes to figuring out, all right, where do I need to be with which draft and when?
Yeah, so I really like Whitney's approach here, because I like that idea of still having book one as you're kind of starting on book two, because that gives you a chance that, you know, when the outline kind of gets away from you and you start to invent things that you hadn't quite expected, it still gives you an opportunity to go back and maybe litter in the foreshadowing or whatever you need to do to make book two work that you hadn't thought of the first time around. When I was writing the Starborn series, I'm a huge outliner. I depend on outlines. I can't get anything done without them. So I had the whole series really, really top level outlined. And then I would go into each outline more thoroughly as I started writing the book. But I was also publishing as a web serial. So it was kind of done and done. Like once a chapter went up online, like, yeah, I can go back and change them, but people have already read them. So right. There's only so much revision I can do. And so my outlines ended up having to change a little bit, because I would write something in book one and then be like, oh, that doesn't actually lead itself very well to what I originally wanted to do in book two or three. But it also gives me a new kind of interesting avenue to explore as well. So having that like top level outline really helped. But if I were doing this the more traditional way, I think Whitney's got it down. I think that's a great idea.
Yeah. And I will say that that does seem to be, that's part of wishful thinking for me, you know, is the first two books in the Empathy series are out there in the world. And though I really do like the shape that they took by and large, there are certainly some things that, you know, some of it's between reader feedback after, you know, the books have been published. And some of it is knowing the direction that I thought I wanted to take book three versus now where I think it would be maybe better to take book three. Well, books one and two are canon. Like, that's it. I don't have the opportunity to go back and change that now. Or if I did, I'd probably be doing it as part of like a brand new relaunch or something for the series. So, yep, good thoughts there, Whitney. It's nice to have that kind of under your control and know the direction you're going to take it as much as you can before, you know, it's all set in stone. So Thank you so much for that. And now, Maggie, we've got the next question in our conversation here talking specifically about something we dipped our toes in a little bit in the first part of this conversation, but we can really embrace it now, is what is it that we address in our second drafts, and what is it that we actually choose to save for later?
Mm-hmm. Well, we've got Avery again. And she says in response to this question, my draft one is essentially a very long outline as I rough out the plot. So draft two is my first coherent draft. I take the initial pieces I created in draft one, rearrange them, and clean up the plot structure. Character arcs and other nuanced elements are for draft three. So I think that's really interesting. I am a chronic outliner, and I have heard some people say that they consider their outline to be draft one. I've never necessarily thought of it that way, but I mean, considering the amount of work I put into my outlines, maybe I should. So this technique is really, really foreign to me, this idea of really saving each draft and giving each draft a purpose. For me, it's more just like, okay, here's my first draft, pause, come back. And I start by cleaning it up a little. I just kind of go through and do some line edits and make note of things that could probably go or change or I need to come back to. That first sweep is really just top level. And then I come back and start doing the really meaty revisions. So Avery's, I suppose that in a way I do have a plan for each draft, but this seems really, really regimented. And I think that's very interesting the way that she's got that idea of really making it more coherent in the second draft, as opposed to whatever it is that she comes up with in draft one.
Right. And this again, really seems like it comes down to knowing who we are as writers and then custom tailoring our process to sort of meet ourselves where we're at. Because I think that perhaps in a conversation like the one we're having right now, or perhaps in conversations that folks might see taking place in spaces like Twitter, there could be this idea that, well, I heard that what you're supposed to do is, you know, even from our own conversation here, well, the consensus seemed to be to wait a month. So I'm just going to do that. Okay, and that's fine. Like, maybe that's what you need to do for your first manuscript. Maybe you're going to hear something here that says, okay, well, I guess maybe I'm supposed to focus on only big picture stuff when I go back to it. But, you know, Avery knows herself here. She knows herself as a writer. She knows that she's going to consider that very long outline is basically her first draft, whatever the case is. So it's about kind of finding your process and just taking all of the feedback we're getting from the community and from Maggie and from hopefully me with a couple of decent things to say here too, and then finding what works for you, right? That's what I want this show to be about. And so I'm glad that Avery's introducing it. I'm glad, Maggie, that you're sharing that perspective. And also for Cinna. Yes, we heard from Cinna this month. Cinna is back tweeting at CINNAEDHVIK. And Cinna had something similar to say to Avery. That being that second drafts for Cinna are about fixing the biggest problems, if any, things like pacing, structure, who gets choices in scenes, and then how the transitions flow. So I really like that, actually, especially talking about things that might be a little more outside the box, because we tend to talk about big picture stuff and people think, oh, like plot. Well, okay, and Cinna gives a nod to plot here in the form of structure, but in really important things that are also big picture that could really go overlooked are things like who gets choices in scenes and then how we transition from one scene to the next as a result of that. So Cinna, thank you for that one. Maggie, does that kind of stir any thoughts for you there?
I'm impressed at the idea of doing fixing the big problems in the second draft. I'm too intimidated by draft two to go that hard. Like I said, I tend to use draft two more of as a quick clean sweep, just give it an eyeball, especially seeing as I've typically taken some time away from it. So draft two is an opportunity to refresh me myself with the actual material. And so I'm more of a make notes of the things that I need to come back to. And I kind of psych myself up to do that in draft three, which actually I think, I'm getting a little ahead of myself, but it is a bit of a psychological thing for me when it comes to second and third drafts.
And I think maybe it has to do with the fact as well that for someone like you who writes from an outline, and even for someone like me who has traditionally written from an outline, your second draft, if you didn't deviate a ton from your outline and you know that it's still sound from that structural level, then that second draft is naturally going to be kind of what you have mentioned your process looks like, or what mine is sometimes, is it's just literally me doing a speed read of the document, taking notes and making small changes before that third draft possibly becomes the space in which, okay, now it's time to really break apart that outline that I thought I had and really give these characters more room to breathe, whatever the particular manuscript is calling for. So I don't know, maybe it's just, again, about understanding, all right, not just who we are as writers and what we want, but the process that we use to create that first draft will probably dictate to some extent what those focus areas need to be. At least I would kind of guess so from where I'm sitting anyway.
Mm-hmm. Yep, definitely. And there's no right or wrong way to do it either. It's like you've been saying, it really comes down to knowing yourself as a writer and what works best for you and your process.
Yeah. And then we had more input here, actually, Maggie, and this is from another past guest co-host. That is author Sarah S. or Sarah Smith. Maggie, if you'd like to share what Sarah had to share over on Instagram, go for it.
Yeah. Over on Instagram, Sarah says, "It's so hard. I do the biggest changes first, then less major, then save the smallest ones for last." So Sarah kind of does the opposite of what I do. In fact, Sarah does the exact opposite of what I do. Sarah makes those big, big changes right off the bat, just dives right in, and then saves the small little tweaks for later. So, kudos to you, Sarah, because I'm not
gotta
that
be
brave.
I guess yep. You just gotta be brave, right? It's just time. It's time. Oh my God. And maybe that's part of, again, it's about developing a strategy to do that. If you think you're ready to take on what we are calling a brave stance here, being that, like, hey, it took me, I don't know how many years I am now into taking my writing more seriously, but it wasn't until 2020 when I decided, you know what, after a first draft, I'm hopping right back into that document when it's time to do that second draft, and I'm writing over the first one. It's just like, I will trust that if I need to remember something, it'll be there waiting for me in the back of my head. And if I'm hesitant about getting rid of something, the second draft maybe isn't the time to get rid of it. I'm going to wait. But for the things that I do feel like it's time to let go of, these are the darlings that must be killed. It's time to burn a kill your darlings candle and make it work for you, right? Haha, hashtag branding. Okay.
Well done. Well done.
The pre-order window is now open for Kill Your Darlings Candle Company's debut line of candles. Yes, their Happily Ever After Dramatic Irony and Kill Your Darlings Original Scents are now all available online with a 20% discount if you order between now and July 31st, 2020. Not only will orders placed during this period receive 20% off, but donations to one of Kill Your Darlings' community benefactors will be doubled during this time. Yes, that's right. If you order between now and July 31st, 2020, you'll get 20% off, and Kill Your Darlings will donate 10% of your order's subtotal to a writing, reading, or literacy-oriented organization of your choosing at checkout. So visit kydcandleco.com/store now to check out their debut candles and take advantage of this extraordinary sale before it comes to an end. Again, that's kydcandleco.com/store. Kill Your Darlings Candles. Candles for the wordsmiths of the world. There it is. All right. It's time for another segue, he said, not at all deftly, by jumping into the next question that we asked you, our friends in the hashtag RightsCast chat community. And that is actually getting more into this idea of the challenges we face in tackling a second draft. So not just what it is we are going to address, but what challenges we face while we're going through that. And then not only just what the challenges are, but how it is that we can overcome those challenges. So Maggie, we have another comment here from Whitney over on Instagram.
Yep. And Whitney again is write_wherever. And she says that the challenges that she's facing in draft two is smoothing out language that I dash down while trying to capture the shape of the idea rather than making it pretty, and rearranging sections for better structure and pacing. It's hard because I like to do things right the first time. And side note, I can appreciate that.
Right.
That's something I took. I'll come back to that. Anyway, she continues, says, "So it's more of a psychological hurdle than anything else. I tell myself that I did do it right the first time for what I was trying to do. And the job of the second draft is different. Nice. I love that. I love that because I used to be the same way. I used to labor over getting that first draft perfect. And I know some people who can do that, but I'm not one of those people because I'll never, ever get it done. And so it was actually getting involved and actually trying NaNoWriMo that broke me of that idea of you got a month, you got to get the words done. And I'm like hyper competitive. So I'm like, I have to win. So yeah, you have to settle for just getting whatever you can down and trust that you will take care of the rest in the revision process. And I love this idea of changing the mental conversation you're having with yourself and saying, I did do it right the first time because what I was trying to do the first time is just get the words on the page. And then my job in the second draft is to take those words and make them a stronger story. Like, I think that's brilliant.
And another thing I loved about this comment from Whitney is talking about capturing the shapes of ideas rather than making it pretty. And this is something actually that for me, I have been trying to make part of my new, we'll call it body of work, because look at me trying to be nice to myself. But the new direction that I've been trying to take the voice that I bring to the page is actually making it more about ideas than about words, because I think there's this idea that as authors and as writers, we traffic in like wordsmithery. And sure, we do to some extent, but what the actual experience is going to be distilled into for those who are engaging with the media we create are ideas. And so if we can start putting ourselves in a position to embrace the idea that it isn't always about just like the words and a formal sentence structure and making things be pretty, but rather what ideas can we put on the page? How can we sort of traffic in this space that exists above the words themselves and between the lines to create a sort of narrative dream for readers that's going to give to them the opportunity to participate in what really is this sort of, it requires active engagement and it is sort of this cooperative storytelling. We're just letting them know what's happening, but we're giving them the opportunity to engage with it on an ideas level rather than a, aren't you so interested in my words level? Mm-hmm. I don't know. That wasn't phrased exactly how I wanted it to come across, but the idea here is ideas over words, I guess, is what I'm going for.
And I mean, at the end of the day, like you have to get a story down. And right. So the pretty words are great. I mean, when I'm not writing my original manuscripts, I'm writing a lot of fan fiction. And so we're talking about, again, chapters that go up in a serial sort of capacity online. And so when I start writing those, I'm like, okay, I need to know where this chapter is going. And especially when you're writing online, I've said this before, when you're writing a novel, it's more like pretend you're writing a movie. Whereas if you're writing something online, you're kind of treating it more like TV, and each chapter kind of has to be an episode that stands up really strong on its own. Hmm. So whenever I sit down to write a chapter, I really have to think about like what is going to capture my reader right off the bat and propel them and keep them so that they'll stick around until whenever I get that next chapter up. So the first thing I do is I'm like, let's just get the action of the story in there. Let's just get that forward momentum. And then when I go back to revise it, that's when I kind of like slap that paint on it and pretty up some of my sentences. Because if your story isn't propelled forward, then you're not really telling a story.
I like the idea of using that metaphor of slapping like the paint on it, so to speak, because we can actually pull that into my admittedly incredibly amateur understanding of how cars are manufactured. So if we think about how a car is built, right, it isn't as if every piece of a car is painted separately and then put together. No, we have to build ourselves a car first. And then at the end, we take the time, well, the robots take the time to slap that paint on it. And that is where we go, oh, okay, now this is where we get that appeal for someone who is on the car lot and goes, oh, this really caught my eye. Then they actually have the opportunity to get in that car, take it for a drive and experience the story of that forward momentum. Look at this metaphor machine.
That is perfect. I think loving you summed it. That up really well.
This is like the ideal time of day for me to be recording, Maggie. I know it's earlier for you than it is for me, but I'm feeling it. All cylinders right now. All right, so let's keep it moving then. We had another comment here from Sarah Smith over on Instagram at author Sarah S, saying that for her, the biggest challenge or among the bigger challenges in second drafts is figuring out where to start. There's typically so much to fix, and Sarah says she can feel overwhelmed. So, and this is perhaps part of what I believe Sarah said earlier, is that she's one of those writers who just goes for making those big, deep changes right away. And if you are in a position to feel like that's going to be your MO, I can see how that would be overwhelming. So I will say, Sarah, very relatable content here, absolutely. But one thing that I like to do to help myself with that is break down these bigger things that I want to tackle into smaller little checklist things, right? It's not, I need to fix pacing, but more like, what scenes do I know I dawdled in, and make a list of those scenes and write down a couple concrete things that I know I can tidy up in those scenes, and then just do those here and there as I'm able. So it's not like, all right, I need to spend 4 hours right now getting the pacing in this manuscript, right? It's like, I got an hour right now. I'm going to touch up 3 or 4 scenes, cut these little bits here, make sure that I'm making our characters remain goal oriented so that we have that sense of forward momentum. And then you check off these little things, and the next thing you know, you fixed pacing. So that's kind of a strategy that I like to employ anyway. Maggie, does any of that resonate with you?
The idea of being overwhelmed definitely does. And that's half the reason I think I wait as long as I do before I get back into it. Is I said it before, I've got to psych myself up. So I can appreciate that, because it does feel, especially second draft when it's all fresh and new, it does feel like there's a lot to fix, and it can be hard to figure out where to start. And so for me, I just start at the beginning and I work my way through. And I think that's why I like to do it's part of the reason why I like to do the small changes first, because it kind of feels, you know, when you've got a to-do list and you're able to get those little things done first and you check them off, and it gives you this false sense of like, look how productive I am, even though you've left the big things.
Right.
Your list looks shorter. And so when I go through it and I fix all those little things as I'm going, and then make note of the bigger changes that are going to have to happen later, I still feel like I'm being productive. And that kind of gives me a confidence boost to do those bigger things later.
Yeah, again, maybe sometimes it's all about, like you say, when we have that list, even if we did a bunch of little things, it looks like we did a really big chunk of stuff, because it just takes up more space on our list, right? Mm-hmm. So playing those little tricks on ourselves and finding what works. And speaking of finding what works, it looks like we have a tweet here again from Avery talking about index cards all over the floor. So Maggie, why don't you take it away with this one?
Yeah. So Avery's back and she says, for me, the hardest part of draft 2 is getting the plot tightened up, plugging holes, sorting out chronology of elements, and fixing paradoxes. I tackle those with the tried and true index cards all over the floor method. It helps me see the structure in a visual way. So I've definitely done the index cards. Actually, I do sticky notes on the wall, but oh, nice. I do that at the outlining point, because mm-hmm. it's such a great visual trick to see the whole book. And if you're a really visual person like I am, and like it sounds like Avery is, it's just so helpful. I'd like do the color coding and everything. I've got a big, I clear the wall and I build the book out on the wall, and then you can like move things around, and I love it.
There really is something to be said for having something physical in like the world to be able to move around and feel like it's very much under your control. I actually also used to use this approach when I was working on like the very first draft of Imminent Dawn in, say, 2013 or like 2012 or 2013, something like that. But then, because I was at a stage of my life where I was moving all of the time, well, it wasn't practical to keep track of index cards and try and keep all of that together. So I actually eventually shifted over to Scrivener, which I know is a product that folks who listen to this podcast are familiar with, because for me, having the security of knowing I'm not going to lose an index card like here or there it meant a lot. And I could still arrange the plot in that sort of visual way, even if on a screen, it was like this nice, happy medium for me. So that's my plug for Scrivener. Folks, you probably have already heard or will shortly hear a full ad for them. You're welcome. But that's kind of what that has me thinking about. So thank you, Avery. And thank you, Maggie, for sharing, your experiences with index cards there as well. Sin is back. He's got more to share. We're talking still about challenges here. And Sinna says this at CINAEDHVIK on Twitter. The hardest thing is getting that big picture view to see the whole story at once and identify where to focus efforts. And I get that. It really is trying to figure out where it is that we actually need to focus our efforts. And I think that's why for me, My second draft is more, again, that sort of, it's a speed read, it's taking notes, it's leaving things in the margins or notes in Scrivener's incredibly convenient little notepad on the side of the document. So then I get to that third draft and it's like, well, now I kind of know where to focus efforts because I've exported all of that into like a Google Drive document and then I kind of know how to reconcile everything from there. So I don't know. Is that, I know that Maggie, for you, you're not someone who tackles these really big things in that second draft, but does that, is this resonating again with you here, trying to get that bigger picture view?
Yeah, I do it more traditionally. So where you're using digital file and Scrivener to do all that sort of big picture thinking, I literally take that, once I've done the quick second pass of just really quickly cleaning up little things, I actually print the whole thing out. And I've got these gigantic binders that I use and color-coded sticky notes, color-coded pens, the whole bit. And I'll mark out where like each chapter is. And then I can make that sort of indexed list of the main things that happen in each chapter. It's a whole thing, but it really helps. It's like you were saying earlier, there's something about having something physically that helps you feel like you've got something under control. And it, can't really imagine doing it any other way just because of the way I think and work. So obviously everyone do whatever works best for you. But for me, I love having that printed out manuscript and I love marking it up and making a mess. And there's nothing quite as satisfying as when you get to parts where you're like, you know what, this just needs to be cut. And you just like page after page of just big red line.
Right. Yep.
It's very, it just very makes you feel very powerful.
As always, this episode is brought to you by the folks at Dandelion Web Marketing. Yes, Dandelion Web Marketing, they're the ones who are helping writers like you build a thriving author platform through strategic web marketing. So if you're not sure if you're on the right track with your website, you can get one of their author website audits and find out. Right now, listeners to the Writescast Network can take 50% off one of these audits, which will look at your site's content, security, design, search engine optimization, and more. And it will provide you with insight into what you might do to better connect with your audience. So to learn the strengths and weaknesses of your current website and save 50% along the way, visit dandelionwebmarketing.com/writescast to learn more. That's dandelionwebmarketing.com/writescast. And there is, again, there's something to be said for feeling the weight of your work in your own hands. I do have two binders of, I believe they're different drafts of the first book in the Empathy series, Imminent Dawn. And I would print them out at a time when I worked at an employer who didn't pay attention to how much paper I was using at the printer. So, you know, my very belated apologies to a former employer. And, you know, it was actually really speedy because at that printer, you could print real fast, double-sided. That was fantastic. And I could do the binding at work on the weekends. Ha ha, got you guys good. Anyway, it was really nice to have that stuff available. And to this day, I swear this is true. Every time it's, you know, we're in spring cleaning mode around here, if we're looking at stuff in the office, my wife will look at those binders and be like, do you still need those? I mean, the book is out. It's been like 6 or 7 years since you worked on them. It predates my wife and I even knowing each other. And I'm like, yeah, I need that. They need to sit on the bookshelf because it's still really cool to look at all the colorful tabs and to be able to open that up and see all the red on the pages and go, look, these are things you can do and it feels good. So keep that stuff, folks. Keep it as a reminder of where you've come from, you know?
It's a souvenir of all your hard work.
Yes, exactly. Because you know what? People aren't going to be reading these earliest drafts once they get through beta readers. So like having that there as knowledge of where, how far you've come as a writer, even when you look back at your style and your approach to the page and how you come into a better understanding of yourself as a creative, it's just really reassuring whenever you're feeling down to look at your past work. And even if you're like, even if it's kind of cringy, well, you don't feel that way about your work now. So you've certainly gone somewhere, right? So, you know, it's worth keeping around. And I mentioned in there beta readers, and that is actually the final question that we asked folks, is about knowing when a draft is ready for those early readers. And why don't we hop into that part of this conversation now with thoughts here again from Ekta Garg at Ekta R. Garg on Instagram. Ekta says this, I give my stories a few drafts and then seek out beta readers. I try to make them as complete as possible, but for betas, I don't see that as a hard and fast rule. I know my betas will point out good stuff and stuff that needs work, and it's a less formal process than submitting anywhere. So if it's not perfect, I won't stress about it. So yeah, fair. It's just kind of knowing, all right, it's not going to be perfect. It doesn't need to be exactly what we need it to be. And maybe we just need help. And Ikta, if that's the space that you need to operate in to get it out to beta readers, awesome. I'm sure your beta readers are understanding of where you are in your process. So that sounds great to me.
I think it makes sense too, because I mean, if you're really married to whatever it is that you're sending out to your beta readers and they come back with feedback, I feel like that just, you know, mentally, emotionally, whatever the case may be, is going to be tougher for you to go back and make those changes, because to you, you did all that work and you feel like you got there. You feel like you've done it and you're giving them this product that in your mind really feels finished. So if I'm not necessarily saying give them your first draft, but giving something that you know probably still needs a bit more work, but you really need that beta reader insight to let you know where to focus your attentions, I think it's the good, it's the best of both worlds, because that way they're getting a good story, but they're also getting the chance to help you as well. And then you don't feel quite as awful about having to not go back to the drawing board, but certainly go back and make changes when you thought you were done.
Right. And that is so smart and such a great thing to say, because I will say that there have been manuscripts where I pass them off to my beta readers, but in my head, I'm like, I love this story. It's great. This is exactly what it needs to be. And then I get feedback from people who say, and this was in the case of Slickshot Abbey, for folks who might remember, my manuscript set in 1870 Arizona territory, where all the beasts of burden have been replaced with dinosaurs. I sent that off to beta readers and was like, oh man, I love this story. I love these characters. Strap in, let's make this happen. And then I got feedback from beta readers that was some of it was conflicting, but one thing that was unanimous was they hated one character in particular. And not in like, oh my God, that villain is so evil, but they thought this character I put in for comic relief was just like a detriment to the manuscript as a whole.
Oh no.
Right. And so I haven't gone back to that manuscript yet, because I'm like, I really like Wilhelm. He's like the snake oil salesman, and he's like this goofy Prussian dude who like is in way over his head. And yeah, I just have to find a way to make him less shenanigans-y. But because I was so married to having him in the manuscript in the way that he was in there, it's been 8 months since I got feedback and I haven't been able to touch that manuscript. So someday, but you know, lessons learned, I guess.
It's rough. Yep. So gotta know where you stand before you let people in. That's for sure.
And then when it comes to knowing where people stand, actually, maybe it's about knowing where we stand in relationship to our work. We had a comment here from Sarah Smith again on Instagram. Maggie, if you want to take it away with that one.
Yeah. Sarah says, when I've revised a few times and I don't hate the story anymore, and there's the crying laughing emoji. And when I first read this, I was like, aw.
Right.
So like, hey, I don't know that I...
Where do we set our bar?
Yeah, I don't know that I have like any like real constructive thought around that. Okay.
that's where we do need to set the bar. It's just like, hey, I don't hate it and I need help. Thanks, everyone. Yep. No, that's totally fine if that's what you need to be in. So thanks, Sarah, for that and for having a little bit of a sense of humor about it. That's we had another thought here from Cinna over on Twitter. Cinna says he thinks his work is ready for betas when he doesn't know what to do next to improve it. It's when he needs that second opinion. So actually a little similar to Sarah's comment, though perhaps not in the same vein of hating one's work. It's just when you know you need that help, right? When you think you've got it to a good place, but you can't tell anymore because you've been so buried in the manuscript. So, hey, let's get everyone together and see what they have to say, kind of thing.
Yep. And I mean, that's kind of the point of a second, third, fourth set of eyes too, is if you can't see the potential problems anymore, then there's not very much that you can do. And I mean, that's kind of how I felt when I went into RevPit. I was like, I was already querying the book and I got a couple of requests for full just as I won. And I was like, oh no,
oh boy,
what do I do? Because I felt fine about the book. And then when I went through it with Michelle, her feedback is that second set of eyes. I was like, oh, I hadn't even thought of that before. Right. Like, that's a great idea. And just made it that much stronger. So yeah, getting people in there just to help you find things that you probably can't even see anymore because you are so close to it is just so helpful.
That's what they're there for. Like you say, it's what they're there for. And actually, speaking of having a few different kinds of people there for, Avery is back with another comment talking about how it looks like she has two different reader rounds, Maggie, if you want to share that tweet with us.
So Avery's referring to critique partners and betas. And so she says she has two reader rounds, one for CPs, one for betas. The CPs get draft two or three when it's mostly readable, but still early. They'll help me address bigger problems I might have overlooked. Betas get a draft when I fixed everything my CPs caught and I don't see any additional problems of my own. I think that makes sense. Like when you think about the distinction between critique partners and betas, critique partners are people typically also writers, people who understand the craft, who can really help you home in on all kinds of different areas, whether it's your style, your grammar, the plot, the pacing, etc. And it makes sense to give them that earlier round, like we were talking about earlier, when you're not really married to it yet, and there's still room to really polish things up. Betas, when you think about it, a beta's job is actually less, they're not really supposed to be there for those craft type, that craft type assistance. A beta is meant to be an early reader, and they're supposed to give you a sense of how things will be received kind of in a more organic sense. So those are the people that you think represent who your ideal readers might be. And they can give you just sort of like, this is how it made me feel. They kind of give you that more soft and fluffy vibes type response to your work. Whereas a CP is really going to dig in there and be like, this needs to go, this could be tightened up, etc. So I think this process that Avery's got going on really makes a lot of sense to me.
And I'm really glad that you're teasing out the difference here between critique partners and beta readers. And another way that we might think about them is that critique partners are perhaps folks who are also writers themselves. And so they can meet you in that sort of writerly language space and say something like, hey, the pacing in your first act felt like it was a little slow, but we really hit the ground running by act two. So you might consider revisiting these scenes and taking a look at like character motivation. These are things, and you know, how quickly they act on those motivations where pacing is concerned. But those are things that writers might have some familiarity with and can give you that feedback. Whereas a beta, they might give you feedback like that. But as you say, Maggie, it's going to be like softer or perhaps not framed that way. And they might just say, yeah, I don't know, the beginning felt a little slow. You know, they mean the same thing, but one is a different kind of feedback because it's coming from someone who is actively participating in the craft of writing themselves with a critique partner, whereas a beta reader is just there to give the impressions of a reader, right? So important distinctions, and it's important to have both, as I am now learning after having left my critique group a couple years ago, and now I'm like, oh my, folks, I need critique partners. This is my advertisement. That's all I'll say about it, but throwing that out into the ether. Anyway, Whitney Hill, again, another comment here from Whitney over on Twitter at @write_wherever. Whitney says it's time for beta readers when she's completed three drafts. First draft, rough ideas. Second draft, fixing structure and cleaning up prose. Third draft, refining the ideas and prose. And then it has to go because I can spend or have spent months quote unquote perfecting a book only to make drastic changes after receiving feedback. So this really ties for me back into the idea of not getting so set on what it is that we wanted to achieve in our first draft, of becoming so married to the inclusion of our snake oil salesman, Wilhelm, that when everyone hates him, you can't snip him right out of the book because your plot's dependent on him to some extent. So yes, I appreciate that, Whitney, and that certainly rings true to me.
Mm-hmm. Yep. I think that like really does sum up everything we've been saying. You know, you just, nothing hurts more than when you love Wilhelm and the people say he's got to go.
I don't know what it was. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, was he too foppish? Was it that he speaks in German occasionally? Is it that he makes strange historical I don't know, folks. I'm sorry. I don't know what I did to wrong you, but Wilhelm, we're going to have to, what are we going to do about you? Oh boy. All right. Conversations for another time. For now, before we get into our main takeaways though, I do want to remind listeners that the Writescast Network, hey, we're supported in part by listeners like You, yes, you can support our programming financially at patreon.com/rightscast. And this isn't just for fun. I mean, you could just give us money for fun, but like, you know, we want to make sure you get something in exchange. And so we do offer some awesome patron perks like Rightscast Network swag. Folks, we've got mugs and t-shirts now. Come on, get on those levels where you can get mugs and t-shirts. It's great. I also offer discounts on my editing services if you are a patron. And we have the raffle for a first 5-page critique that we do at the top of every one of these episodes, or at least that I edit in after we recorded the episode. And, you know, you get exclusive, early, ad-free access to every episode. I try to get everyone access to the month's episodes on the first day of the month. So you're listening to some of this stuff 4 weeks before the rest of the public can get to it, which could make a big difference if there's a topic we're covering at the end of the month that you know is coming up in your revisions right now. So hey, $1, $2, $3 per episode or per month, any amount helps and we appreciate all of it. So hey, patreon.com/rightscast is the place to be.
Yes, and we'd especially like to thank Laura Hazen and Angeline Boley, whose contributions at the Wise Mentor level earn them shout-outs in every RightsCast Network episode, on top of all the other great patron rewards they receive.
That's right. So again, patreon.com/RightsCast, folks, that is the place to be. But all of that said, let's hop now, Maggie, into our main takeaways from this episode. For me anyway, Maggie, I think that when it comes to tackling second drafts, it's just about finding your process. It's about knowing who you are as a writer, what your strengths and what your areas for improvement might be, so that you can get into that second draft mindset, knowing, again, here, this isn't the place for perfecting. This is the place for a little bit of polish. This is the place for getting familiar with new angles that we might take into this story when it comes time to do future drafts, and really getting ourselves comfortable with the fact that creativity, any kind of creativity, but particularly in the world of writing, you know, this is an iterative process. And with every iteration of our manuscript, the goal is to just make it a little bit better. No matter how we choose to do that, all of them are going to be valid. So that, to me anyway, Maggie, is what my main takeaway from this episode is. What is it that really stands out to you?
Yeah, I agree. That idea of just your process is your process. And if you have found something that really works for you, don't worry about what everyone else is saying. It doesn't matter. What does matter is that the second draft is there to help you. And it's super common, I think. Hopefully we've managed to gather that from all this feedback, to feel a little intimidated going into that process. It can feel overwhelming, but you just need to take a step back. You need to come up with a battle plan and find something that works for you to get from point A to point B. Because when you're done, it doesn't matter how much you think you love draft one, you're going to have such a great story when you've taken that time and you've really given draft two and then subsequent three, four, however many it takes to really create something awesome. So don't be afraid of the second draft, but you know, do what feels good.
Right. Love it. Great advice for writing second drafts. Great advice for all of our creative endeavors. So thank you so much for that. Really good takeaways, I think, here from this episode. And listeners, it's time. We're already going to look ahead to our next episode because you, of course, will help us pick the next topic for that episode. We're going to have a poll up on Twitter and you can help us choose between writing synopses and writing dialogue. Maggie, I know that in my head, I really want listeners to choose one of those over the other for our next episode. I'm not going to say which, but please don't let me down, listeners. That's one I really don't want to do. But anyway, the power is yours. The power is yours, listeners. Head on over to the @RightsCast handle on Twitter and make your voice heard, and it'll become the topic for our next #RightsCast chat series, which will, of course, be on Twitter and Instagram running from the 24th through the 28th of July with a single daily prompt. You can swing by whenever you've got time to do it. Throw in your 2 cents, throw in your 8 cents, throw in your 97 cents, whatever you have to spare in terms of insight. We will take all of it and then we'll incorporate it in our next episode. So all of that said, thank you, listeners, for joining us for this episode of Novel Approaches here on the RightsCast Network, brought to you by Dandelion Web Marketing, Lost Lake Press, and everyone's favorite Kill Your Darlings Candle Company. If you liked what you heard, we'd love it if you could leave us a rating and review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts.
And for more writerly podcast content like this, visit writescast.net or follow us on Twitter at writescast. And I mean, if you like me, you'll like what you're hearing. I'm also on Twitter. I'm at Maggie Derrick. And I'm also on Instagram at Maggie.Derrick because someone got there first. Ooh. Come say hello. Come say hi.
Look at that. So we've got two different handles there. Keep that in mind, listener folk. I am on Twitter as I am R.R. Campbell, but I'm also on Instagram as I am R.R. Campbell. And I'm on Facebook as I am R.R. Campbell because I'm sneaky like that. Anyway, thanks as well to everyone who participated in our hashtag RightsCast chat on Instagram and Twitter. Whether your feedback made it into this episode or not, I actually think this month everyone who contributed made it into this episode, which is always fantastic to see. So I do appreciate your input, folks. And next up on the RightsCast Network, next week here, July 17th, I have interviewed author Judith Joy about the law of attraction for writers. So it is a very positivity-centered episode. If you're feeling a little down right now, if you're having a hard time creating, Judith's insight can help. So July 17th, visit us on writescast.net or wherever you listen to podcasts to catch that episode.
Awesome. Well, I think that's it for this episode of Novel Approaches. Thanks for listening.
And until next time, you know what to do. Write on and write well. This is the RightsCast Network, brought to you by Dandelion Web Marketing, Lost Lake Press, and Kill Your Darlings Candle Company, and always streaming at RightsCast.net.